Universal Time. Stay tuned for Daybreak Africa coming up after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Victor Beatty reporting. Russia is reacting strongly to President Donald Trump's decision to sign into law measures sanctioning Moscow for its Ukraine policy and alleged meddling in last year's U.S. election, a charge Moscow has denied. Prime Minister Dmitry Medvedev warned it ends hopes of improving ties. He also called it a declaration of economic war. Vasily Nebenzia is Russia's new U.N. ambassador.
I really wonder, is there anything in this world today which Russia is not guilty of? Some of U.S. officials were saying that this is a bill that might encourage Russia to cooperate with the United States. To me, that's a strange sort of encouragement. But it's not our habit to be resentful children and to be, to get offended with anything that happens around. We will not relent on finding ways and means to cooperate with our partners, including the United States.
White House spokesperson Sarah Huckabee Sanders said Mr. Trump signed the measure in the interest of national unity, despite what she called significant flaws.
The president favors tough measures to punish and deter the bad behavior of the rogue regimes in Iran and North Korea. And he also sent a clear signal that we won't tolerate interference in our democratic process by Russia.
Sanctions were extended against North Korea and Iran, which promised a proportional response. At least four people were killed Wednesday after gunmen ambushed a convoy of buses in South Sudan. Several others were wounded. There was no immediate claim of responsibility. The attack occurred on a main highway between the capital of Juba and the Ugandan border. At least 14 people were killed in a similar attack back in June, claimed by a rebel group in the midst of a four-year civil war in South Sudan. This is VOA News. Brazil's President Michel Temer survived a vote in the country's lower house of Congress that could have launched a Supreme Court trial leading to his ouster on corruption charges. Congress voted 252 to 214 against opening legal action against Mr. Temer for accepting bribes from a meatpacking company. Peter Hockham, senior fellow at the Washington-based Inter-American Dialogue, said Mr. Temer now has some political space to act on much-needed economic reforms.
His victory is being able to push back against the country's attorney general and avoiding his case going to court. He is in a slightly better position than he was last week, but not very much more. His overall approval rating in poll after poll is below 10%.
Hockham said his proposals, such as pension reform, are highly unpopular. Venezuela's election chief has denied claims by the British-based Smartmatic voting technology firm that turnout numbers for last Sunday's controversial election to form a new assembly were manipulated by at least a million votes. Tipisay Lucena, head of the country's electoral council, described the company's statement as irresponsible, grounded in baseless information. But the head of the British company said there is no doubt in his mind. President Nicolas Maduro said he plans to swear in members of the new assembly Friday, insisting it is the only way to pull the country out of its severe economic crisis. In Afghanistan, a suicide bomb attack on a military convoy in southern Kandahar province killed two U.S. soldiers. It was an attack claimed by the Taliban. There was no information about wounded. U.S. Secretary of State Rex Tillerson will meet Asian leaders in Manila beginning Saturday during a gathering of the Association of Southeast Asian Nations. Acting Secretary of State for East Asian Affairs Susan Thornton said he'll seek further to isolate North Korea.
We continue to seek broad international cooperation to respond to North Korean provocations, and we call on the international community to enforce the UN Security Council resolutions passed to date, including the sanctions regimes within, and to drastically reduce their interactions with Pyongyang.
Tillerson may hold talks with his Chinese counterpart. Thornton said China has taken significant steps to pressure the North to give up its nuclear missile programs, but added Beijing could do more. Campaigning in Rwanda ended Wednesday ahead of Friday's election. The longtime incumbent, 59-year-old President Paul Kagame, is expected to win easily. He faces two candidates, given only a few weeks to campaign. In New York, the benchmark Dow Jones Index broke the 22,000-point level Wednesday, buoyed by a healthy second-quarter earnings report from tech giant Apple. The Dow, which has expanded 11% this year, gained another 52 points to 22,016. I'm Victor Beatty.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Mbatha in Washington. Today is Thursday, August 3rd, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Campaigning ended Wednesday as Rwandans go to the polls tomorrow to elect a president.
First of all, let me say that we are happy with the conduct of the presidential election campaign. It went on smoothly, it went on peacefully. I want to commend the candidates, I want to commend their supporters and everybody that was involved in this process.
Charles Muyaneza is Executive Secretary of the National Elections Commission of Rwanda. We'll talk with an opposition candidate who says Rwandans are ready for a change. Gambia's government cancels over 271 diplomatic passports, and a group of young South Sudanese weigh in on peace in their country.
Basically, what I'll say about politics in South Sudan is it's a political of interest, sub-interest. Our politicians are being so self-centered and forgetting the reason as to why they fought to have a country that is called South Sudan.
Jacob Ball is a member of the Young African Leaders Initiative from South Sudan. A member of an opposition group will share his views on why he thinks South Sudan's national dialogue will not succeed. And Botswana prepares to host the Dalai Lama over China's objection. Those stories plus our listener of the day are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Campaigning ended Wednesday as Rwandans go to the polls tomorrow, August 4th, to elect a president, the country's third election since the 1994 genocide. President Paul Kagame, who some say engineered a referendum to change presidential term limit, is running for a third term, and if he wins, would remain in power until 2034. Charles Munyaneza is Executive Secretary of the National Elections Commission of Rwanda. He says the commission is happy with the peaceful conduct of the campaign and wants to commend the candidates and their supporters.
First of all, let me say that we are happy with the conduct of the presidential election campaign. It went on smoothly, it went on peacefully. I want to commend the candidates, I want to commend their supporters and everybody that was involved in this process, including security, including local government officials, including the media. We ended peacefully. Now, as far as we are concerned, we are set. We have already dispatched the materials. We have dated. Everything is in place for these people to cast their votes.
Charles, what do you say to people who say this exercise is a far-gone conclusion, that it was a waste of money, that President Kagame is already going to win, and that you did not allow a lot of people who could have contested in the election to compete?
Well, I would say that those people that are saying that, they are either not informed or they are not aware of how we do things here in Rwanda. As I talk now, we've been having three presidential candidates campaigning across the country. If it had been a foregone conclusion, then I wouldn't have expected the three candidates running and crossing the country campaigning and soliciting for votes. I would have expected these people not to have campaigned. So the fact that we have had the three candidates running up and down looking for votes, there they know that it's not a foregone conclusion. And as far as we are concerned, there is a competitive electoral process. It has been shown as we have been seeing these campaigns and everything is set. And let's wait and see how people of Rwanda are going to decide as far as the electoral campaigns are concerned, and also the polling stations and polling centers are concerned.
Your country has received high praises for the number of women who participating in politics in your country, for example, in parliament. What is it like for this election in terms of women candidates this time around?
Let's not first talk about women candidates. Let's first of all talk about how many women are participating in these elections as voters. In fact, out of the 6.9 million registered voters, we've got 54% women who are registered voters. And when you have 54% registered voters as women, then you can think of the decision that they are going to take. So let's not just look at the candidates, but also look at who is participating to vote. After all, we are talking about inclusive electoral system, inclusive electoral process.
You know, I asked that question because I spoke with a professor here in the United States who wrote an article called The Myth of Women Empowerment in Rwanda. suggesting that perhaps while there's this lots of women in Parliament, that these women have no power.
Can I know if that professor is a Rwandan or an African?
She is an American.
Sometimes the problem is that these people who are not familiar with the system that you have in Africa, sometimes they tend to interpret, and sometimes they claim to be experts. And so I would have loved to hear from a Rwandan or an African that's making that kind of opinion. But if it is a professor from America, an American, who has never been to Rwanda, I would have loved to have that person here in Rwanda.
Charles, thank you very much always for speaking with us on Daybreak Africa.
Thank you very much.
Charles Muyaneza is Executive Secretary of the National Elections Commission of Rwanda. He was speaking with me from the capital, Kigali. As Rwandans vote tomorrow, Friday, for president, some say the outcome is a foregone conclusion that longtime President Paul Kagame will win re-election for a third term. Frank Habineza of the Democratic Green Party is one of two opposition candidates who are challenging President Kagame. He says his chances of upsetting the president are good because Rwandans are ready for change.
I would say that we still have chances because the people of Rwanda have seen they are yearning so much for change. And people want to see a new leader, and they're tired of the same government for just some 3 years. And they've been promising this to us wherever we passed, wherever we've gone, and we have fought big crowds also over 200,000 people again came to our campus in some areas, some districts, over 100,000 and so on. So we've seen that people are yearning for change. And we have a 65% chance of winning this election.
You said the people of Rwanda are yearning for change, but yet if you talk to the government, they will tell you that the people of Rwanda want President Paul Kagame to continue in power, as evident by the fact that the constitutional referendum went through so that the president will continue in power until about 2034. How are they yearning for change if they did that?
Well, the result of the referendum is not something you can base on because they don't represent the full wishes of Rwandans. The referendum was organized holiday, and we, our party, were against that seal of the constitution. We didn't give any chance to campaign in the villages. So basically, the result of the referendum that came out is not the result that all the Rwandans who have had a chance if they had voted. They have been different. So we believe that if we had been given a chance to do a campaign, because we're not allowed to do campaigns, we would have voted differently. But basically, we don't base our facts on the referendum.
Are you giving some time on the national broadcaster? In other words, how do you send your message out to the voters? Do you get time on the national broadcaster?
Yes, every candidate has equal time, 6 seconds. 70 seconds, the public cable to propose on the radio or video.
So you think that it's possible you can upset the president?
Yes.
We wish you all the luck, Mr. Habineza, and we shall probably get back to you again, probably on the day of election and maybe after the election. Thank you very much for speaking with us.
Thank you very much, and wish you a good day.
Frank Habineza is president of the opposition Democratic Green Party of Rwanda. He was speaking with me from the capital, Kigali. You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte, Washington. Today is Thursday, August 3rd, and please send your comments and opinions to daybreakafrica@voanews.com. Daybreak Africa time is 14 minutes past the hour. The Gambian government has cancelled over 271 diplomatic passports issued by the government of former President Yahya Jammeh. The decision was announced on Wednesday. Panderi Umbai reports.
Former Gambian dictator Yahya Jammeh, his Moroccan-born wife Zainab Zuma Jammeh, and children, including close family members of the Jammeh family, were among those whose diplomatic passports had been cancelled by the government of President Adama Barrow. Overall, 271 diplomatic passports have been cancelled by the government. Among those affected includes former ministers, diplomats, businessmen, and some foreign nationals. Mr. Sekou Cisse is a communication officer at the Ministry of Foreign Affairs.
In March 2017, the Ministry of Foreign Affairs, International Cooperation and Gambian Abroad issued a press release urging all those in possession of Gambian diplomatic passports, diplomatic and service passports, and who are no longer in public office who are entitled to enjoy such state privileges to surrender the said passports.
Mr. Cisse tells VOA that some of the former government officials have complied with the government's order.
What I can tell you is that, you know, those in the country complied, most of them complied. As we know, they have submitted their passports, you know, former ministers and former senior government officials.
The former Gambian dictator Yahya Jammeh is today virtually stateless, given the recent cancellation of his diplomatic passport. Mr. Jammeh and his family are living in exile in Equatorial Guinea. Ibu Jallo is a former army captain. He's also the spokesman for the former military junta which propelled Jammeh to power. Mr. Jallo says Jammeh's days are numbered as far as justice is concerned.
This is the first step towards eventually trying to prosecute him or trying to bring him back to the Gambia to face charges. This is not good for the former president, and it's honestly an embarrassment.
Indeed, it is an embarrassment for a former dictator who used to brag that he owns the Gambia. Ms. Fatou Camara is the former press officer for the exiled Gambian dictator Yahya Jammeh. She was fired and jailed for more than 21 days before she could resettle into the United States. She also had her diplomatic passport cancelled.
I was issued a diplomatic passport based on my position as a senior government official, and my diplomatic passport was never handed to me. It was a passport that was kept at the office of the president for travel purposes. Each time I travel with him, the protocol will handle it.
Now that Jammeh's diplomatic passport has been cancelled, there is growing call for his extradition to face justice in the Gambia. Among those calling for Jammeh's extradition is Pas Samba Jau, a Gambian political activist based in Washington, D.C.
Well, I think his future is very gloomy where it is now, because he is a guy now who used to control the whole state. Now he is left without even a document to travel with. One thing that Gambians would definitely want to see is for his extradition back to the Gambia, so that he will be tried for the crimes that he has committed.
For now, Mr. Jammeh is living in Equatorial Guinea without a valid passport. Reporting for Daybreak Africa, this is Pandering by Reporting.
A representative of a group calling itself the People's Democratic Movement of South Sudan says the national dialogue will not solve the country's conflict. Hakim Dario Moy says the process is controlled by President Salva Kiir and will not produce any results. Dario says the international community should come to the rescue of the South Sudanese people by taking over the national dialogue.
The situation in the country where there is no progress in terms of resolving the conflict and the war situation, try to bring it to a halt.
And who are you blaming for this situation that you are saying it's not making any progress? Who are you blaming?
Yeah, I'm blaming the government in Juba. I'm blaming Salva Kiir.
Why would you blame the government? What are you doing to rectify the situation? Why would you just jump into a conclusion blaming people? What are you doing to address the situation?
We're working on diplomatic efforts, for instance, to try to bring in the input of the international community that actually sponsored the peace agreement, but they did not support the agreement to its conclusion, and they allowed the agreement to be violated without consequence. And that's why we have the situation that we have today.
And when you say we are working with the international community, that sounds vague. What is your party doing on the ground to address the situation?
Well, we have issued a policy statement that we have published on our website. We have also circulated it within the international community. And we have very, very specific recommendations and proposals about how to address the current situation. The first is to focus on a more transparent and neutral and inclusive political process for the national dialogue. That the parties are not steered by the government for the purposes of what they want to achieve, but more inclusive political process that includes all of the stakeholders in the peace process. But the current process is not credible, and therefore has got no chance of being successful.
But how would you react to what the government is saying, that some of the stakeholders are just by themselves? I mean, there are people who are just writing from their bedrooms in the diaspora, and they call themselves that they are a movement for the people. How would you react to the government's conclusion that some of you are not even legitimate?
Yeah, they can say what they like, but the reality on the ground is that there are more than 500,000 of our people who have fled the country. They have fled the SPLM government. They have fled the government of Salva Kiir, and they went into Uganda, into Ethiopia, into refugee camps in Sudan. So he cannot dispute that. Why are the people running away from him? the regime has become illegitimate. It has the legitimacy of the agreement, which it has not implemented, and therefore it's an illegitimate regime. I think the international community should not tolerate that. Let the people, through a national dialogue process that is inclusive, that is transparent and credible, come up with definition of what the future looks like, what they want to have, the system of government that they want, and the political process that needs to include everyone.
Hakim Dario Moy is a representative of a group calling itself the People's Democratic Movement of South Sudan. He was speaking with John Tanza of U.S. South Sudan in Focus program. A group of young South Sudanese here in Washington, as members of the Young African Leaders Initiative, or YALI, are calling on the youth of South Sudan to wake up and steer their country towards a better future. They stopped by our Washington studio to deliver a message to both the government and armed groups in the country's civil war.
My name is Jacob Bull. Basically, what I'll say about politics in South Sudan is it's a politic of interest, sub-interest. Our politicians are being so self-centered and forgetting the reason as to why they fought to have a country that is called South Sudan. What were they envisioning when they had the country? I mean, when they were fighting, what were they envisioning? To have a country. But after having that country, what are you going to do with it? Lead it. But where's the leadership? The social fabric is broken. So what I will tell the people of South Sudan is, be an exemplary leader.
I hear a lot about tribalism in South Sudan, and people think that the conflict going on there is on tribal level. Let me hear from you. What do you think? Let me hear your view about your society, the place of women in your society. Your view, please.
Hello, this is Margaret. Thank you once again. Yeah, the conflict in the country currently is termed as a tribal war, simply because when you look at the parties that are in conflict right now, you find basically that most of them are being supported by the tribe where he or she comes from. And that's how it ended up being a tribal war, because if it was something that is a national war, then I am sure by now it would have stopped. And then looking at the other angle of how women are treated during this war, I think the most affected people in South Sudan are the women.
So as you all get ready to return to South Sudan, what are your hopes and aspirations?
My hope is to have my hope from that I ask from the leadership or the country is to have an environment where young entrepreneurs can be able to flourish. As much as we have that hope, I'm looking also to contribute to that. The skills that I've obtained from the University of Nevada, I believe I can be able to sit down a few young people and pass on this amazing knowledge that I've obtained. So basically, we need an environment for businesses to flourish. And businesses are the backbone of an economy. If we want to build a country, that will be our main pay to dedicate our resources in.
My name is Miriam, and my hope and aspiration when I go back is that it's more similar to what Abuni has just said. South Sudan has a literacy rate of 27. Many people are not knowledgeable. And when we go back, what we'll take back and educate the people, create awareness, hope in the long run, 10 years, you know, many people will be educated and will be able to contribute to the country.
I'm Jacob. My hope when I go back home, and I have actually already started, is that the youth of South Sudan will one day wake up and realize the position they're put in. And they will raise up to know what are their roles, what are their responsibilities, and what do they expect to be done. So it's about them. The country is theirs, and they're the one to get it out of the stagnant situation it is in. I have that hope, and I know South Sudanese youth love themselves.
My name is Margaret once again. For me, my hope in South Sudan currently, what I look at is the young people. Those are the youth, because already among the politicians and our elderly, they have grouped themselves according to their interests. And of which, when somebody is already having interest, there is no common goal that can be achieved. So I only have hope that if we youth come together and work, we do positive activities, try set up our own businesses, work together with other fellows, advocate for peace. That's the most important one. Then we will see this country back.
So as I listen to all of you, it seems to me you are telling the people, your country, that the future of your country lies in your hand as young people. Thank you very much for coming on Daybreak Africa to talk to us about your aspirations.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you for having us.
the views of a group of young South Sudanese here in Washington as members of the Young African Leaders Initiative, or YALI. They spoke with me in our Washington studio. Botswana's government says it will welcome a visit from exiled Tibetan spiritual leader, the Dalai Lama, later this month, despite warnings from major investor China. The Dalai Lama will be in Botswana for a human rights seminar, but may also meet with President Ian Khama, which could draw more rebuke from China. Neighboring South Africa has denied the Dalai Lama 3 visas in the face of pressure from China. From Johannesburg, viewers Anita Powell has more.
Until a few weeks ago, says Lawrence Seretse, editor of the Botswana Gazette, few people in this nation of 2 million people even knew who the Dalai Lama was. But now the exiled Tibetan spiritual leader is making headlines in the Southern African nation as it prepares to host him August 17th through 19th for a human rights conference in the capital, Gaborone. China, which happens to be one of Botswana's largest trading partners, has repeatedly objected to the visit. China is a leading investor in the Southern African nation, reaching a high of more than $1 billion in direct investment in 2011. China says the Himalayan region of Tibet has been part of its realm for more than 7 centuries and considers the Dalai Lama to be a dangerous separatist. He has led a shadow Tibetan government in India since he fled into exile in 1959. Here's Botswana's government spokesman, Jeff Ramsey.
He's coming here on a private visit to take part in a seminar, so it's a kind of academic seminar over 3 days. He may meet with the president. The president has indicated that that's a possibility.
If those two statements, a private visit that includes a meeting with the head of state, seem contradictory, that's because, Seretse says, they are. He says the government is playing a dangerous game by not taking a clear stance on the visit. Neighboring South Africa has on 3 occasions bowed to Chinese pressure by not granting the spiritual leader a visa. China has snubbed other nations for hosting the Dalai Lama. Most notably, Beijing suspended high-level diplomatic ties with Britain after then-Prime Minister David Cameron met the Dalai Lama in 2012. China also opposed former President Barack Obama's meetings with the spiritual leader, but did not follow those concerns with concrete actions. Seretse says he sees merit in the argument that Botswana is a sovereign nation and should be free to decide whom to host, and in the argument that Botswana should show support for human rights activists by inviting the Dalai Lama. But, he says, governments cannot afford to be vague, and that Botswana's government needs to make its position clearer.
We as a country haven't clearly stated what we want and what we are going to do if anything happens. What we have been doing is that we have been going back and forth with contradicting statements.
China's government has condemned the pending visit. Foreign Ministry spokesman Liu Kang addressed the topic last week. China, he said, has made its position clear in demanding that the relevant countries shall earnestly respect China's core interests and make the correct political decision on this matter. China will not interfere in other countries' internal affairs, but will not accept another country doing anything that harms China's core interests. Beijing has not specified what action it may take if the Dalai Lama does visit, but Ramsey says his government is confident that China and Botswana will remain friends. Anita Powell, VOA News, Johannesburg.
And that's it for this Thursday, August 3rd edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, I'm James Butte in Washington, wishing you, in Africa, a very, very good day.
Hello, this is Peter Clotty, host of Nightline Africa. Please join us every Saturday and Sunday at 16 and 18 hours UTC. Nightline Africa is VOA's Africa's weekend show that provides news, features, and entertainment news about Africa and the world. Tune in. You will be glad you did. I guarantee it.
Interested in deeper analysis of news and events in Africa? Then plan to join me, Douglas Impuga, on Reporters Roundtable every Thursday at 17:30 UTC. We'll have African journalists and expert guests discuss the topic at hand. We take a deeper look at important African news topics. So plan to be with us every Thursday at 17:30 UTC, right here on VOA Africa.